You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, thousands of Wisconsin tax returns may come back slower than usual this year. We'll find out why.
First, President Trump wasn't the only major political figure giving remarks yesterday. Attorney General Jeff Sessions made his first big speech as the nation's top law enforcement official.
Speaking to the National Association of Attorneys General, Sessions talked about what to expect from the Justice Department. He's calling for a crackdown on violent crime, but also hinted that the federal government may back away from monitoring troubled police departments. In addition, some are wondering if a crackdown on recreational marijuana could be coming based on some of Sessions' comments.
I, as you know, am dubious about marijuana. As states, I get, can pass whatever laws they choose, but I'm not sure we're going to be a better, healthier nation than if we have marijuana being sold at every corner grocery store. I just don't think that's going to be good for us.
Del Quentin Wilbert joins us now for more. He covers the Justice Department for the Los Angeles Times. Del, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, even though the nation has seen a big drop in murder and violent crime since the 80s and 90s, Attorney General Sessions referenced that, but he's worried about this more recent uptick in violent crime and homicide. How would you describe how he handled that issue?
Well, he takes it very seriously. He believes that, we had a rise in violent crime and murders in the United States from 2014 to 2015, and many big cities right now are kind of struggling with a rash of murders. Now, it's still way below levels of over the last two decades, and they're near historic lows. He doesn't view this as a blip. He views this as a potential trend, sign that things are going to get a lot worse over time. To combat that, he wants to be more aggressive in the Justice Department's posture on gangs, cartels, and groups that kind of fuel street violence.
Yeah, and it sounds like he's looking to, in a way, federalize some of the efforts against those groups, even at local levels in certain cities. Is that right?
No, I think he would like to augment more. I mean, they're gonna set up a task force and look at it, and I think he's gonna direct U.S. attorneys and local FBI and DEA and ATF agencies to focus more on this matter.
So, what would that look like in practice?
I'm not really sure. I think it'll probably be more of like a, we have to obviously wait and see what he does. He is obviously pushing, he wants to push more gun prosecutions, for example. So, in the Bush years and Clinton years, they had Project Exile, which would, if you were caught committing a crime with an illegal gun or a gun, you went into the federal system and you got a mandatory minimum 5-year prison sentence with no parole. Right, no possibility of getting out early. And he was a big fan of that. He's a big fan of tough drug sentences, though when he was a senator, he did push to make crack sentences commensurate with powder cocaine. So, it's been an interesting few weeks in the new Trump administration.
Yeah, there's been kind of pushback against the idea of mandatory minimums and longer sentences in recent years with a prison reform movement and sentencing reform movement on the left and on the right. Senator Sessions in general not sympathetic with that, it sounds like.
No, I don't believe he is at all. I think he is kind of a law and order kind of guy. He's a very conservative Republican. There are Republicans who are pushing for, criminal justice reform. I don't believe he was one of them. With some Democrats who viewed drugs is more of a public health crisis. He is definitely of the mind that, drugs fuel crime. As drug use goes up, crime becomes more problematic. He is not a fan of marijuana use. Right? You could tell that he and his aides are going to be wrestling with the whole idea of states' rights, which Republicans generally favor, and states legalizing marijuana versus federal, there are federal, obviously federal anti-marijuana laws that he wants to enforce. And so that's going to be an interesting conflict to see it play out.
Yeah, there's been a lot of speculation about whether the Trump White House and the Attorney General in particular would start enforcing federal drug laws when it comes to states with legalized marijuana. What has he said? Has he tipped his hand in any way so far?
No, I don't think so. I think that talking about it is certainly a change. He addressed the former Deputy Attorney General under Holder, wrote a memo that directed prosecutors to focus on the big fish marijuana dealers, not so much the retailers in Colorado and Washington and things. And he liked aspects of that memo, he said, in terms of how you deploy resources. But he also said the next breath he doesn't think more kids smoking pot is good for the country, nor would it be good to have marijuana sold at every grocery store.
We're talking to Del Quentin Wilbert from the Los Angeles Times, looking at a speech from the new Attorney General, Attorney General Sessions. He was talking to attorneys general from around the country yesterday. Getting back to law enforcement, supporting police departments has been a big theme from the new Attorney General. He doesn't like, it sounds like, a lot of the investigations that went on under the Obama administration over civil rights and other issues in police departments. What did we hear yesterday?
That's exactly what you heard yesterday. He believed that, and in an interview and in a press conference he gave the day before to the Justice Department press corps, he does not believe that these investigations, and also during his confirmation hearing, you know, he has been pretty clear he doesn't think a lot of these investigations do much good. They drop morale, they hurt crime-fighting, police back off. I think he believes in investigating individual acts of civil rights abuses, but maybe not taking like the systemic look at the Obama administration actively pushed to investigate police departments for patterns and practices. Because, you know, a lot of policies departments have can help fuel like errors and mistakes and bad, bad arrests and not good training or poor training. And so that's what the Obama administration focused on. It'll be interesting to watch as he gets into it if there's another Ferguson, Missouri, or Chicago, or, you know, Eric Garner, and those were all, you know, where black men have been killed by white police officers, and there's unrest related to that, what kind of political pressure that puts on the Justice Department to perhaps step in and try to mitigate that. And what's also what he's going to find interesting, that a lot of police chiefs actually welcome the Justice Department to come in. For example, the police commissioner in Baltimore would welcome the Justice Department during their investigation after the Fetty Gray incident, because he knew that the Justice Department would help him reform his department and get the money necessary from the city council. It's really hard to turn down a federal judge when a federal judge says you have to do these 10 things to fix your police force, and it costs a lot of money, that you have to do it. And so a lot of them welcome the additional resources and investigation.
You mentioned Ferguson, and that reminds me of this idea of what people have called the Ferguson effect, the worry that police departments and individual officers are worried about being caught up in civil rights issues and problems and maybe not doing as aggressive enforcement as they should. I don't think Attorney General Sessions used that phrase, but does it sound like he's sympathetic with that concept?
He's totally, completely sympathetic with that concept. He actually said, you know, I think he had a similar quote, if you check my story, that he said at his confirmation hearing, very similar, you know, and that's what James Comey has put forward and a lot of police chiefs have put forward. I'm not sure there's no scientific evidence to that. There's probably some anecdotal evidence to that. But the other side would say, hey, if you're policing correctly, you're not going to get jammed up. The most egregious cases are the ones, that are pretty obvious. And, you know, like Darren Wilson in Ferguson, he shot Michael Brown, you know, and no crime. He was investigated. No, he wasn't charged with a crime. The Justice Department even said there was not enough evidence to prove a crime had been committed. But he did have a lot of potential administrative issues that came up. And, you know, if he had handled himself, the department had trained him better, and he had handled that situation better, things might have been different.
Big picture, a lot of the things we've heard from the Trump administration, a lot of the executive orders would require some action from Congress to put them into effect. How much latitude does the Attorney General, though, have to make some of the changes that Attorney General Sessions might want to make?
Oh, I mean, he has a lot of power and leeway. He can, you know, he can push for the hiring of more immigration judges, for example, in immigration enforcement. He can, you know, the Justice Department, focused a lot of attention on investigating police departments. He may shift those investigators and to other kind of avenues to investigate. He may, rather than focusing on fraud cases, he may shift prosecutors over to work on cartel investigations. You know, he has a lot of discretion on what kind of cases they bring, what kind of cases, for example, U.S. attorneys are rewarded for bringing. But he did make an interesting point. He's like, you know, U.S. attorney's offices in various states have a lot of, they're the ones where most of the work is done, not so much out of main justice, although there is the criminal division, national security division, civil rights division. They do a lot of work. And he wants those U.S. attorneys to respond to the individual needs of their jurisdiction. So he was a U.S. attorney in Alabama, for example. Rudy Giuliani was up in New York, and Rudy Giuliani was an associate attorney general and urged all the U.S. attorneys to focus on what their local law enforcement groups needed. And so in New York, they focused on the Gambino crime family. And he said that would have made very little sense to me in Mobile, Alabama, because I don't have any Gambino crime family members in Alabama, but I had these other things I needed to investigate. And so that's what he wants to do. I think they already kind of do that already. But, you know, a lot of the stuff that Just Pharma does is not going to change. It'll be more maybe policy and encouragement on what people get rewarded for doing.
Finally, as we wrap up, what are you watching for as Attorney General Sessions swings into action? What are some of your big unanswered questions?
It's what we've just talked about. Like, I want to see how the rubber meets the road. I want to watch how it happens. I think that's critically important to see. And that's what I'm looking for.
Del, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks so much. Have a great day.
That was Del Quentin Wilbur from the Los Angeles Times. He joined us to talk about what Attorney General Jeff Sessions had to say in his first major speech yesterday.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll find out why some Wisconsinites will have to wait longer than usual for their tax refunds.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Fewer than 20 people speak the Menominee language fluently. Ron Korn Jr. has devoted his life to saving his language from extinction through the community-based Menominee Language Institute.
What I'm doing is ensuring that the language goes a generation beyond myself. And I'm going to do that through my kids, you know. I think it's hard for her to want to speak because nobody else does, you know. There's probably about 8 people that speak. We'll call it 10. She got 10 of 10,000, you know. What's that percent? 0.001. 0.001%. So that's a reality check. The language, it could die, but the idea that we're trying to preserve is a living language. Pamatashimikot, it lives. So there's words readily available for everything in nature. The word for falling snow is petnon. The word for snow on the ground is cone. Crusted snow, wanai, you know, we say wanai. And the word snowflake is even different yet than both of them. We say peiwitsit. The beautiful thing is it's that much easier in the woods, you know, because our language is really based on what's going on out there. But how do we make that transition into today's life too, you know, because we're not always sugaring, we're not always ricing. We spend a lot of days at home, in the office, on the road, and we got to learn to express those things too, you know. The language has to make that transition if it's going to be relevant and if it's going to survive, you know. When I was young, my first main teacher, Wasichewan, she was starting to get sick and forgetful, you know. One day we were just sitting at her house talking, and she tells me, now I can die, she told me. For 25 years, she said, try to teach someone this language. Now today I've done that. Then she continued on in Menominee, you know. She said, kana poch kitchen and you and the sawi and She says, you know, maybe you're going to be an old man, she says, when you hear these kids talking our language. She said, I love you. Don't give up. Hey,
This story was produced by Finn Ryan for The Ways. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, if you've already filed your state income taxes and you're expecting a refund, you may find yourself waiting longer than usual. An anti-fraud effort will slow down those refunds for thousands of Wisconsinites, with a turnaround time going as long as 12 weeks.
Jason Stein reported on this story. He covers state capital news at the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. Jason, welcome back.
Oh, my pleasure, Rob.
Well, tell us, first of all, Jason, how many people will see slower than usual refunds this year?
The department says between 60 and 90,000 people, so it's really a good-sized city's population, something like Appleton.
And tell us about the anti-fraud effort that's behind this.
Right. So state officials say that they have seen in recent years higher cases of identity theft, in which criminals take someone's identity and then attempt to file a fraudulent tax return seeking to get income tax refund sent to them instead of to the person who paid the taxes.
So this would be, if I'm the criminal, I'm finding somebody's social security number, whatever other information I can get in identity theft, and then getting a fraudulent refund, their refund, I guess, sent to me.
Correct. It's not a situation necessarily where the person wouldn't still get a refund, but obviously it's a problem for both that person, who's going to have to then prove, you know, what happened, and the government and taxpayers who are out the money that they've sent to this person.
And what kinds of amounts are we talking about that the state has caught in recent years?
It's been a growing amount that the state has of income tax refunds that have been blocked. Now, this is not the same as saying all of these cases are proven cases of fraud. Some may be inaccuracies. But the number has risen from $10 million about 5 or 6 years ago to more than $60 million last year. So, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars over this period.
And how does the state flag these? Or I guess from what you wrote, the state kind of outsources this.
Well, right. And this was one of the things that surprised me, is I have talked with some tax filers who are concerned because, you know, one gentleman who's African-American and lives in Milwaukee was concerned because his income tax return has been flagged 3 years in a row, and he's concerned that something in this process for flagging suspicious returns might have a disproportionate impact in lower-income neighborhoods. And so I asked the state about that, and I was surprised when they told me that they don't know how their vendor flags suspicious returns.
Right, and who is this vendor?
The vendor is a company called Fast Enterprises, and they work for a number of states, including Minnesota, Illinois, and Michigan, and they have a proprietary process that they take data on known fraud cases from states like Wisconsin, and then they come up with a computer model that identifies other cases where something similar might be happening. And, you know, so I'm trying to get a sense from the state about, well, what factors are being zeroed in on here. And so far, I have not gotten any information.
Right. I guess the key word there was proprietary. The company doesn't want to share this and have competitors know how they're doing it. So it's, looking at it from the outside, it sounds like it's a black box.
I think that's fair. I think that's fair. I mean, the state does say that they have looked at cases. You know, obviously they know the cases that are the returns that are getting flagged and the filers that are getting a letter sent to them saying they have to verify their identity. And that process can take from anywhere from several weeks to up to 3 months. And they say they don't believe there's anything discriminatory going on. But I do think it is an issue for the public in general, that as more and more government decisions get made by computer algorithms, and sometimes computer algorithms that are developed by private companies, there's always going to be this tension between a company wanting to make money, which is a legitimate thing, and the public also wanting to know what, you know, how are the decisions of government getting made, which I think is also a very legitimate thing.
Now, getting back to the taxpayer who is caught up in this, you mentioned if I am flagged, if my return is flagged, it's not a secret. I know about it, right?
Correct. And you have a chance to deal with it. And in normal circumstances, it should be dealt with, in a fairly straightforward fashion. You can get a PIN number and give it back to the state. You can answer some quizzes about information, you know, personal information that you would know and presumably a criminal would not. Or you can provide other documents. This can be, you know, this whole process can take maybe just 3 weeks to get your refund, but it sometimes can take longer. I talked with a gentleman who didn't get his refund last year until June, he said.
Yeah, does the state have an ETA? Are they saying as much as 12 weeks or whatever number?
Right. From 2 to 3 weeks up to 12 weeks, from a person giving the state, you know, contacting the state, you know, getting their letter, responding that, yes, it's me, Jason Stein, it's my refund, and then eventually, you know, getting that check.
We'll leave it there for now. Jason, thanks so much for bringing us up to date on that.
Thank you, Rob.
That was Jason Stein, state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, telling us why state income tax refunds are moving slower than usual this year for many Wisconsinites.
Coming up, we'll talk about the power of resourcefulness and how to do more with less. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to this to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up after 7, it's Storytelling with a Beat on Snap Judgment. Tonight's theme, One in a Million. There are lots of things that are never supposed to happen, but once in a while, something slips through the cracks. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
Now, when it comes to achieving success in our professional and personal lives, it seems like we're always chasing after more. We need more resources to make more money. We need more staff to get more work done, and we want to provide more for our families to make them happy. But does any of that actually make us happy, more successful, or really improve our lives?
Our next guest makes the case that instead of being chasers, we should be stretchers, or people who make the most out of what they already have. He says that by relying on our resourcefulness, we actually find more creative and productive ways to solve problems, innovate, and be more engaged by our work and personal lives.
Scott Sonnenschein joins us now. He's a professor of management at Rice University. He's the author of the new book, Stretch, Unlock the Power of Less and Achieve More Than You Ever Imagined. Scott, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Scott, we've heard the phrase, a lot of us, less is more. Sometimes we might meet it with some skepticism, but make the case that actually it can be a positive way to approach work and life.
We often think of putting ourselves in position of constraints as something that we want to avoid, but what the research shows is that when we have our backs against the wall, either because our objective circumstances warrant it or because we get ourselves into this mindset, we're able to look at all of the resources around us, whether it be physical things like products or objects or immaterial things like relationships, in much more creative ways. We give ourselves a license to use resources in less conventional ways that allows us to actually get more done.
And this is something that you have been through yourself, especially during your time working in Silicon Valley. Can you talk about what happened with that?
Yeah, I was in Silicon Valley during the dot-com boom and bust, and it was a crazy time to be out there because people judged metrics of success not so much on what they were doing, but on the resources they were acquiring. It was always a race for, can we get more venture capital without actually thinking, what are we going to do with all of this money? How many employees can we hire each week? How many customers can we get, even if they're actually not profitable? So the focus became accumulation. It's this idea I call chasing, which is when we orient all of our energy, all of our efforts on trying to get more resources without actually reflecting what are we trying to accomplish, what are our goals. So we end up mindlessly accumulating lots of resources that, one, is really draining. It hurts our satisfaction. It makes us feel inadequate because there's always someone who has more. But two, and more importantly, it takes our eyes off of what it is we're actually trying to get out of life.
You mentioned chasing, and that's a key concept in your book, and it's matched up against what you see as a more positive concept, and you know, in the title of your book, a stretch, stretching. What do you mean by that?
Right. Stretching is about taking what you have and finding better uses for it. Chasing is simply the idea that if we have more, we can do more. Stretching is that nice contrast that says it's not so much what you have, it's what you actually do with what you have that matters. It's about unlocking that natural creativity that we all have and using our resources in more productive ways.
And you open your book with a story about someone who did stretch, the owner of a small brewery, and he was able to successfully compete with some of the big giants in that area, and he did it by staying small and stretching with what he had.
Right, because when we're stretching, I'm not saying that you're giving up on trying to achieve great things. It's actually quite the opposite. You could achieve really wonderful things. So in that case, it's the brewer, Dick Yingling, and what he was able to do is, well, lots of the competition were going under. They were going bankrupt, or they were selling their businesses to large brewers. He reflected on what his goals were, which is, I want to keep a family business, but I also recognize that growing into a absolutely humongous company is not part of my goal. I want to build a very successful company, and he built an enormously successful company doing it, but he limited the number of markets he went into. He limited the advertising budget that he had, and he was able to slowly grow. And you see the same pattern if you look at the history of the dot-com era, where about 50% of the dot-com companies went out of business, but those that survived tended to follow a very similar pattern as Yingling did with his beer company, which was growing slow, being mindful of what your goals are, and recognizing that if you're going to try and hit a home run on a short amount of time period, there's more likely than not the chance that you'll strike out.
Talking to Scott Sonnenschein, he's the author of the book Stretch, Unlock the Power of Less and Achieve More Than You Ever Imagined. Want to get into how we can actually put this into practice, Scott, and a theme that seems to come up all through your book is we need to figure out what we want in the end, what our expectations are before we can figure out how best to use our resources for it.
Right, and the problem is too often we engage in what psychologists call mindless accumulation. So in one study I talk about in the book that was done by Christopher Shi at the University of Chicago, he had people come into his laboratory and he said, okay, I'll give you the chance to earn some chocolate. But here's the thing, you got to actually work for the chocolate. So there were two stages of the experiment. In stage one, you had to press a button as you were listening to nice leisurely music, and that button interrupted that music with the sound of a saw cutting wood. In the second phase, after you earned your chocolate, you were able to eat the chocolate. Now, what happened, of course, is people overworked. They kept pressing the button, listening to the saw, having to do that work to press the button, and they couldn't possibly eat all of the chocolate that they had earned. So he imposed a cap in the next series of studies, and then what that cap did is it had people better calibrate because it literally prevented them from possibly earning more. But what's most interesting, I think, about this study is that people who had the cap, who were told that they had to stop working, both had more satisfaction when they were doing the work to earn the chocolate, as well as more satisfaction when they were actually eating the chocolate. Because what that cap did is it made them more mindful of the goal. The goal was not simply get as much chocolate as possible, because there's only so much you can eat. The goal was to get enough chocolate to keep you satisfied.
But isn't that kind of antithetical to the world that we live in? I mean, we're taught to be ambitious, and being ambitious means shooting for the stars, in this case, accruing piles of chocolate, and that's what you're supposed to do, isn't it?
Well, I think there's a distinction between being ambitious and achieving your goals. Now, we can have very ambitious goals, but all too often we forget what our actual goals are. When we focus so much on trying to, you know, get the bigger budget at work or the larger office or the bigger house, we're not thinking, well, are those actually really our goals? In some cases, they might be our goals, and that's okay. But in many cases, we're simply doing these things because we see other people around us doing these things, and we forget about what our actual goals are. So there's people in the book that I profile that, you know, running very successful businesses, and they have a choice to make. Do I want to take some outside money and grow this business and try and do an IPO with it and make it a $1 billion business, or am I more satisfied running a $30 million business that gives me more control over my business, maybe a better work-life balance? So people have lots of different goals, and it's okay to have really ambitious goals, and lots of people have run very successful businesses by stretching towards those ambitious goals. But we need to be mindful of what those actual goals are, and too often I don't think we are.
And you don't just talk about business in the book. You also apply this to the creative sphere, and I love that you gave an example of Dr. Seuss writing Green Eggs and Ham. It is his birthday and Read Across America Day. Can you talk about the limits that made Green Eggs and Ham happen?
Yeah, so what he did is he had a bet with his editor that he wouldn't be able to write the book by only using 50 words. And, you know, that's a really hard thing to obviously do. And he was able to readily do that bet. And we can do the same thing when we think about our lives, whether it be how we impose time constraints or how we try and do something without the traditional resource that we would use. And it turns out that we often overestimate what we need to accomplish our goals, and we underestimate the versatility of the resources that we have. And the Dr. Seuss example is a prime example of that. You would never think you could write one of the all-time best-selling books only using 50 words. And in fact, I argue that one reason why it became so successful is because he only used 50 words.
Does this tie in at all to the research on the paradox of having choice, that when there's too much choice, we freeze up and we're unhappy with what we picked, but when there's fewer choices, we're happier?
Yes, I think that the choice overload research that people like Barry Schwartz have done is a really good example, because, again, our intuitions are we want more choice, and more choice would make us better. That's how a traditional economist would approach the problem. But it actually turns out that by having so many choices, we overload how we can possibly think about things. How many, you know, pairs of different styles of jeans can you possibly look at and consider in your choice set at the store? So there's definitely a tie-in to thinking about choice overload.
You give some exercises to try this in our daily lives, and some of them involve, okay, taking that thing, like a kid's birthday party, I think is one example you give. You could do, you know, sky's the limit, as much money as you want to spend. You suggest, we're going to do this kid's birthday party, we're going to spend $25, and we're going to make the most out of that. Can you talk about how we can learn from an exercise like that?
Right, because again, until we actually try this, we just assume that you can't possibly get stuff done when you impose these types of constraints. So even this past birthday party for my older daughter, we tried this exercise and didn't spend a lot of money on her party, and we had this nice scavenger hunt where people foraged around the park and looked for different types of resources that you can make a little device that you can drop an egg from 10 feet, and they had an absolute blast. And they had a blast for several reasons. One is, and I think children are a prime example of this, is that they are naturally creative and want to explore using things in different ways. The problem is all of our institutions, whether they be schools or even our families, and certainly by the time they work, try and stamp out that type of flexibility, thinking, and resources. We tend to try and teach people how to use things in very specific ways. You want to get a nail into the wall, you want to use a hammer. You wouldn't even think about using the bottom of your shoe if you didn't have a hammer around. So it makes it hard to get into this mindset of using things very flexibly, because we're told that the best way to solve problems is to go find the perfect tool, go acquire the additional resource. So when we put on these constraints, whether it be how much money we spend on a birthday party or what type of objects we use to solve a problem, like getting a nail into the wall, we start to begin to teach ourselves that actually what we have around us is a lot more valuable than we realize.
We're talking right now with Scott Sonnenschein about the power of resourcefulness and why being more resourceful can improve our professional and personal lives. He's the author of the book Stretch: Unlock the Power of Less and Achieve More Than You Ever Imagined.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What was a situation in your life that maybe caused you to be more resourceful? What happened and how did that turn out? And do you think that we're more innovative when we're forced to work with the materials at hand? Maybe they're a little more limited. Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our conversation with Scott Sonnenschein, professor of management at Rice University. He's the author of Stretch: Unlock the power of less and achieve more than you ever imagined.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you practice this idea, less is more? Have you had to be resourceful in your job, in your life? Do you do your best work when given limited resources of money, material, time? And what questions do you have about being more resourceful? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we take our first caller now. We have Eric joining us in Hazel Green. Eric, hi.
Good morning. Good afternoon. I love this idea of resourcefulness. I the story I have about being resourceful is I used to be a high school band director, and my high school band was about ready to march at Disney World, took the kids all the way down there, and they were ready to go, and my drummer comes to me and says, my snare is broke, my drum is broke.
Ooh.
And we just happened to be standing next to a dumpster, and I was able to pull out a coat hanger and wire it up, and it worked perfectly.
Wow. So you did some dumpster diving, and you fixed the drum. Eric, that's a great story. And what do you think about that, Scott? A good example of resourcefulness there.
Yeah, it's a terrific one. I actually have a section in Stretch called From Trash to Treasure, and that seems like a perfect example of it. And it's about how do we get into this mindset where when the right tool isn't there, we don't freeze up and say we've got to stop what we're doing, but we look immediately to our surroundings, find things around us, and give them new meaning and new uses, and they're able to move on towards our goals.
Yeah, don't you have a section in your book where you talk about how kids can remake their toys instead of buying new ones? They can just combine old ones in new ways.
Right, and you give new life to toys that way. I've got a younger daughter who likes to play with Elsa dolls and Shopkins, and both of them grow stale after a while. But when you set up the story that Elsa got a new bag of Shopkins today, how is she going to play with them? Suddenly, both become a lot more valuable, and that takes care of entertainment for the day.
Thanks for the call. We'll go next to Anthony with us in Milwaukee. Anthony, hi.
Hey there. How you doing? Thanks for having me this afternoon.
Yeah, what did you want to tell us about, Anthony?
Well, it was a couple of different things, but one was ancestrally in my lineage, which being an African-American, you know, some soul food recipes or just recipes in general, how we prepare and what we prepare, you know, as far as in the way of food goes, were out of not necessarily what we wanted, but, you know, what was readily available at that time. And, you know, those things were limited. So they had to be, you know, rather creative to come up with meal plans to satisfy and maintain, what they had going on with limited resources. And secondly, it's unfortunate, but it's absolutely true, and there are some brilliant minds behind bars. You know, even those in solitary confinement with the least amount of access to, you know, anything that you might want or need, but they're able to, you know, do and come up with amazing plans and tools. And, you know, you'd be amazed, just like Martha Stewart brought home her prison recipe book, you know, and those are things that people come up with because, you know, they can't go to the grocery store. You know, they shop at a window, and, you know, you got a lot of high starch, high sugar, high salt things, but, you know, there's still things that you can prepare and are prepared. And, you know, as you see, you know, she came home and made money with that, you know, in concert with what she already had going on.
Anthony, thanks for the call. So a couple of situations, lack of access to resources, poverty, and an extreme situation, incarceration, Scott. Anthony seeing a lot of resourcefulness in those situations.
Right, and actually food is a great example where you see this. I spent a bunch of time studying food trucks, and that's a very resourceful industry itself with limited resources, lots of constraints in terms of the cooking experiments. And if you actually go back even to, meat rationing during World War II, I mean, the origin of the meatball itself, too, and how you combine it with breadcrumbs was a way of dealing with, not having enough meat. And I think that's a way that we tend to think of resourcefulness, is that when our backs are naturally against the wall, that's when we go and activate it. And what I'm trying to get across in Stretch is that same type of thinking we can also use when we're in better times, because it helps us focus on what our goals are and helps us achieve those goals by making the most out of what we have, even if it's relative abundance.
Let's go back to our callers now. We've got Denise on the line in Cashton. Hi, Denise.
Hi, thanks. I really like this conversation. As an artist, I like to limit my palette to just two colors, and that way it pushes me into a deeper level of creativity, and I think my best work comes out of limiting my palette as opposed to having the entire rainbow in front of me.
Interesting. Denise, have you always done that, or is that something new you're working with?
Kind of like the other callers had said, that when you only have certain colors available and you're not going to go out and buy more, it's out of necessity, and also it makes it more fun. So it's just sort of been my style.
Denise, thanks for that. And Scott, getting at that innovation there that we can find by putting some limits on ourselves or acknowledging and being okay with our limits.
Right, and I think Denise's intuition is right. She's actually in the same path that Claude Monet took. And one of the things that Monet was really known for was his imposition of constraints. And if you look at the history of the way that he painted, he kept finding new ways of imposing constraints on him, such as, you know, light-dark contrasts. And what that does is it teaches what makes someone a terrific painter or terrific at anything isn't that they can just do it in one way. It's that they can do it in lots of different ways. And every time we impose a constraint on ourselves and we change the rules of the game, we learn how to do things differently and potentially better. And that's the way that we keep growing.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Scott Sonnenschein, author of the book Stretch, Unlock the Power of Less and Achieve More Than You Ever Imagined. Back to our callers now with Sam on the line in Madison. Sam, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. And you might have touched on this earlier in the program, but resilience is something that people have talked about being restricted in people. So I just wanted to know if your guests had any comments on resilience as it pertains to being resourceful and if some people are just more prone to being resourceful or not.
Thanks for the call. Scott, what do you think?
Well, I do think that when we're acting resourcefully, we're able to be more resilient because we're not getting held back by a setback, and we're recognizing that we might not have the ideal tools or materials or enough time, but that doesn't mean that we have to stop or that we should stop working towards our goals. So resourcefulness is definitely one factor that can drive into resilience. In terms of whether or not resourcefulness is something innate, I don't think it is. I think that there's some type of individual differences that people have in creativity that might make them more capable at first glance of acting resourcefully. But what the research shows is that it's actually not so difficult to get into this type of stretching mindset and simply thinking about scarcity, even if scarcity isn't in your current environment, can put you into this mindset. So it's very much a learned skill that anyone can do, whether they have a little or whether they have a lot.
And Scott, just briefly as we wrap up, can you leave us with one concrete piece of advice or tip to try to get into that mindset?
I would focus on trying to impose constraints on ourselves. Now, we might have different access to resources and be in different types of circumstances, but if we just get a taste of what it's like to act with a little less than we think we actually need, we're going to learn that we actually sometimes can do more with less.
We'll leave it there. Scott, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you again for having me.
That's Scott Sonnenschein, professor of management at Rice University. We've been talking about his new book, and we've got a link to some suggestions, by the way, on the Central Time Facebook page. His book is Stretch, Unlock the Power of Less and Achieve More Than You Ever Imagined.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.